Well, if you have ever booked a hotel room or a vacation rental, and let's be honest, this is how we do this anymore. And as I was thinking about this, I thought, man, if you think my example that I'm going to use is difficult, I don't know what we did before we had the internet and we did all this. But if you've ever booked something like that, just based solely on the pictures that you've seen online, you know how important and how powerful good lighting and a wide-angle lens can be. The pictures, the rooms are huge, they're luxurious, they're clean, they're beautiful, and then you get there, and it's not that the place is a mess, it's not that it's a dump, but it doesn't quite measure up to what the pictures, they're not, the pictures didn't lie to you, they just weren't telling the entire truth. A good marketing campaign or a good marketing kind of setup is about shaping perception. And that's how our world works. We have corporations, politicians spend millions and millions of dollars and countless hours trying to convince us that if we would just put our support behind them, if we would pledge ourselves to them, if we would get behind them and give them our support, then in return they would give us the life that we have always dreamed of. And it doesn't matter how many times we do that, they never deliver fully on the goods. We might get a little taste, like that picture of the vacation rental, but they can never quite deliver on what it is that they promise. It's all a glossy brochure with just the right lighting and just the right camera angles. Well, if you've been paying attention as we've journeyed through the book of Revelation, this vision is not worried about right camera angles and good lighting. It is showing us everything in stark relief, showing us just exactly what happens when we put our trust in those empty promises and pledge our allegiance to the wrong things. It doesn't matter how often or how much they promise, they can never deliver on what they're promising. And it doesn't matter how powerful and big and scary they are, in the end, we know that they lose. But that's the good thing about the book of Revelation, is it doesn't just leave us hanging with the bad news, because every time we go through that cycle, it sets us right back down in the throne room with the one that John is introduced to right at the beginning, the one who holds the stars, who walks among the lampstands, the first and the last, the one who was dead and is now alive. And we're reminded as we hear the voices of the 24 elders and the creatures and all of these that are around the throne, we're reminded of who it is that is actually in charge of this whole thing. It's not the empire, it's not the beasts, it's not the monsters, it's the Lamb. And that's where we come to as we pick up the story, the vision, again in Revelation 12. And this time, the vision takes a little bit different twist because the curtain's getting pulled back even a little bit more. And John is not only seeing the effects of the decisions and the choices that we make as humanity in our rebellion, he's starting to show us the things that are behind what's going on. And today, we're going to meet three monsters, basically, a dragon and two beasts, one that comes out of the sea and one that comes out of the land. And this is what we read in Revelation chapter 12, verse 1. A great sign appeared in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet, and a crown of 12 stars on her head. She was pregnant and cried out in pain as she was about to give birth. Then another sign appeared in heaven, an enormous red dragon with 7 heads and 10 horns and 7 crowns on its head. Again, not the most pleasant image in the book. But unlike some of the other things that John tells us or John sees that we're not quite sure what these things are, he doesn't leave us in suspense about who this dragon is, because a couple of verses after this, he tells us pretty plainly. The red dragon is Satan. He represents Satan, the ancient serpent who deceives the world. And as we encounter the dragon, we see that he's standing before this woman that we encounter in the first verse there. A woman who is pregnant and about to give birth. And as he's waiting there, he's waiting for one purpose. He wants to devour the child that she's about to give birth to. Now, You can put some of these things together. There are many scholars that see this woman as representing God's covenant people through whom the promised Messiah would come. Obviously, the first one that comes to mind is Mary. But there's a sense in which she also represents Eve and Sarah and the people of Israel and all of those through whom God would bring his promise, which leads us to the child that she's carrying is obviously representative of the promise, the Messiah, Jesus himself. So the child, it's a vivid picture of the entire biblical story. From the very beginning, Satan has been trying to stop and derail God's plan of creation and redemption, and he has used all sorts of means to do so. Right at the beginning, he tempts Adam and Eve in the garden. He used Pharaoh to try to destroy the nation of Israel and to kill Israel's sons. He used Herod to try to kill the infant Jesus. Again and again, the dragon attempts to stop God's work, but again and again, the dragon fails. The child is born, and Revelation tells us that he is caught up to God's throne, and then John describes this war in heaven in which Michael and his angels defeat the dragon, and Satan and his angels are hurled down to earth. Once again, heaven erupts in celebration. And I want to just make a brief side comment on this. Depending on the translation that you have, when there is a transition from scene to scene, a lot of times you'll see the word then, which the more I read, most scholars don't think that's a very good translation, because it tends to us thinking that this is a chronological series of events that John is witnessing. And there is some of that in there, but really the important thing to get is that what John is seeing is a comprehensive view. And so actually a better word would be, and I saw in heaven, or and. So as he's looking around, he's taking all of these things in that have happened, are happening, and will happen. I know, it's crazy. It's hard to wrap your mind around. But that's what John is witnessing. And this happens to be one of those things, because that battle between Michael and his angels and Satan is reminiscent of when Satan is cast from heaven and he takes a third of the angels with him. Well, we know that's already happened. As we read through this, that's one of those things to keep in mind. But listen to what is sung as heaven erupts. In verses 10 and 11, it says, "Now have come the salvation and the power and the kingdom of our God and the authority of his Messiah. For the accuser of our brothers and sisters, who accuses them before our God day and night, has been hurled down. They triumphed over him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony. They did not love their lives so much as to shrink from death." So yes, the Lamb, the Messiah, wins the victory, but also the people who have pledged their allegiance to the Messiah, to the Lamb, also overcome through this victory. And again, catch how it is that they overcome. They don't come with weapons that the world uses. They overcome by the same two things that they will overcome all through Revelation: by the blood of the Lamb and the word of their testimony. That's one of Revelation's great themes. We see it over and over again. First, the theme that the war has been won. We, you and I, all of those who have gone before us, all of those who will come after us, what Scripture refers to as the great cloud of witnesses, the communion of the saints, we have lived, will live, and are living in light of the victory that the Lamb has already accomplished. We overcome because the Lamb has overcome. And we take that victory as ours, not through taking it by force, but through confession. Through confessing our allegiance to the Lamb and letting that shape who we are by the blood of the Lamb and the word of our testimony. Now, I would like to think that would make our enemy passive and a little more dangerous. It doesn't. Because if you've ever gotten an animal trapped that's scared, they're almost more dangerous when they know they've been defeated. And that's exactly what we see happen with the dragon. He's not pulling back. In fact, he gets even more and more angry, more and more furious. He turns his attack back on the woman and her child. He couldn't get to him the first time, and so Michael and his angels have to take him out, and so he comes after them again. But this time, the earth itself rises up to protect them. And so eventually the dragon realizes that he can't get to the woman or her child, and so who does he turn his attention to? The followers of the Lamb on earth. And that's where chapter 13 begins. And I know we're flying through this, but if you think 13 weeks is a long time to spend in the book of Revelation, just imagine if I unpacked everything that we were going through in the book. We would never leave. We'll get out of here eventually. But chapter 13 begins as John now watches the dragon recruit two partners to assist him on earth. And this is what we read. The dragon stood on the shore of the sea, and I saw a beast come out of the sea. It had 10 horns and 7 heads with 10 crowns on its horns, and on each head was a blasphemous name. And so we see that these beasts, as we're going to see, are really offspring of the dragon. They have the same traits as the dragon. The heads and the horns and all of that, we've already seen that description. And this creature that John sees is terrifying. It has 7 heads, 10 horns, each with a crown. It combines the features of a leopard, a bear, and a lion. And those images are not new. Those images come directly from a vision that Daniel had in chapter 7. There he's taking together all of these empires of the world throughout history, all the way back from Egypt and throughout. And John is seeing them as one big scary monster, as a beast. And he does that to make a simple point. Every empire or every entity or every spirit that exalts itself against God is eventually going to look the same. It is going to become a predatory beast that devours people rather than serving them. And that's exactly what we see happen here with this beast. Now, for John's readers, we've talked about this, that beast, at least in an earthly sense, they immediately recognized as the Empire of Rome. That was the earthly partner that the dragon had at that time, who was carrying out his will. But the image is not limited to a single imperial monster or anything like that. John is giving us, again, a comprehensive picture that includes all empires, all spirits at all time, as well as the monsters behind them. There's a spiritual realm that I think we need to appreciate more, that is kind of what's going on behind the scenes of everything that we experience and everything that the good and the bad. And that's what John is getting to see here. And then he records the world's response, because this first beast is vicious, it's violent. It pours out its own form of wrath on the people. And John says this: people worshipped the dragon because he had given authority to the beast. And they also worshipped the beast and asked, who is like the beast? Who can wage war against it? So in other words, it's just they get to a point where it's, if you can't beat them, join them. They have been intimidated. They have been beaten into submission. They look at this beast and they say, look how powerful they are. Man, there's no use resisting. It's going to destroy us. We might as well give in. And again, this is another theme. It's something that we see throughout Revelation. Whenever there's an entity or an empire or spirit that demands the kind of loyalty that belongs only to Jesus, it eventually takes on the characteristic of the beast. And that's as true today as it was in the first century. So what's the church up to? What are the people of God up to while all of this is going on? Well, John gives us a kind of surprising but not necessarily comforting answer. He says this: if anyone is to go into captivity they will go. If anyone is to be killed with the sword they will be killed. This calls for patient endurance and faithfulness on the part of God's people. So what's happening with the church? A little captivity here, a little captivity there. A little death by sword here, a little death by sword there. It's not sunshine and roses and walking by peaceful streams for the people of God. And do you notice again what's required of them? The same thing that has been required every time they encounter one of these difficulties in Revelation. It calls for patient endurance and faithfulness on the part of God's people. The beast demands honor and allegiance. The church's call is to refuse to bow to the beast. But at the same time, our response is not to become a beast in turn. We are called to overcome the same way that he overcame, with sacrificial love, with patient endurance, and with faithfulness. So John shows us the dragon that's behind the curtain. He introduces us to this first beast from the sea, this monster of frightening, coercive power. And then he introduces a second beast into the story. In verse 11 of chapter 13, it says this, "Then I saw another beast come up out of the earth. He had two horns like those of a lamb, but he spoke with the voice of a dragon." So at first glance, this second beast doesn't seem quite as scary as the first one. It looks like a lamb. That first beast, to use a pop culture reference from a few years ago, the first beast is Freddy Krueger. You know to run away from Freddy. It wants to scare you into submission. It threatens you with power. Do what I say or else. The second beast, though, he looks like a lamb. But where you can tell the difference between him and a lamb is that it speaks like the dragon, which is exactly how deception works. I don't know about you, but when I have encountered things that have been leading me astray, it will rarely just tell me off the bat, "Hey, look at me, I'm evil." If only it would do that every time, then it would be a lot easier to discern. This is a bad path. It doesn't always work that way. It doesn't always show up wearing a red suit and carrying a pitchfork. It looks reasonable. Sometimes we can even explain it to ourselves that it's necessary. It borrows the appearance of goodness. It looks like a lamb, while it speaks with the voice of a deceptive dragon. Now, don't get me wrong. The second beast will kill you just as quickly as the first one, but only after you haven't listened to its deception, after its seduction doesn't work. Now, if the first beast represented the Roman Empire, it's likely the second beast, in the imagination of John's first hearers, represented all of the people who represented the empire, kind of the local officials and things like that throughout Asia Minor. They were the ones who promoted emperor worship. They were the ones who said, "Just burn a little incense to the emperor and everything will go fine for you." They built temples to Caesar, they organized public festivals, and they created this enormous social pressure to conform. Their job wasn't primarily to use force, that was the empire's job. Their job was to shape the imagination of the people and convince them that Rome was worthy of their undivided loyalty. So the first beast uses intimidation, the second beast uses propaganda. One threatened, the other persuaded. One ruled through fear, and the other used seduction. And I can tell you that they make a dynamite duo for the dragon. They are very good at what they do. And honestly, again, this isn't something that is just people experienced in the past, and it's not something that we have to be afraid of or just aware of in the future. It's something that we experience right now. We live in a world in which powerful voices, loud voices, voices that do not stop, are constantly trying to shape what we love, what we fear, and where we place our hope. The reality is every day we are being discipled by something or someone. The question is who or what? Who are we giving our attention to? What is it that we are allowing to shape our affection? Is it Jesus? Or is it the dragon and his surrogates? That brings us to one of my favorite passages in all of the book of Revelation, and one of the most misunderstood passages in the entire Bible, as John writes this: "It also forced all people, great and small, rich and poor, free and slave, to receive a mark on their right hand or on their forehead, so that they could not buy or sell unless they had the mark, which is the name of the beast or the number of its name. This calls for wisdom. Let the person who has insight calculate the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man. That number is 666. We are all aware of the number 666. It's happened more than once recently that I'm on Facebook and I will see just the number of comments on a post, and it just happens to land on 666. And there's just something within me that says, I need to comment so that I can get it off that evil number. You see the kind of pull and influence it's had on our lives. But of all of the verses in the book of Revelation, these few have caused some of the most unnecessary and sensationalized fear in history. For years, Christians have lived with this anxiety about the mark of the beast. What is it going to be? Have we already gotten it? Did I take it accidentally? Is it going to be a tattoo, a barcode, an ID number? Can I offer a suggestion? What if it's not a physical thing at all? What if it is something that is deeper and much more subtle, and in turn, much more dangerous? Because if Satan is the master deceiver, wouldn't you think that his greatest deception would be a little bit more deceptive? I mean, think about this. If the government tomorrow were to say, every person needs to go down to their local city hall or courthouse and get a tattoo that says, 666, I reject Jesus. None of you would do that. At least I hope none of you would do that. And that's just the Christians. Even some of the other people out there probably wouldn't do it because it's just too obvious. And it's weird. That's not how deception works. The dragon isn't stupid. He's subtle. He's smart. And he's patient. He doesn't usually tempt us by saying, come worship evil. He says, this is practical. This is reasonable. This is just how the world works. Everybody's doing it. That's the second beast's language. He doesn't look like a dragon. He doesn't look like a beast. He looks like a lamb. He imitates what's good. He borrows the appearance of truth. He wraps compromise in respectable clothing. That's what makes the second dragon almost twice as dangerous as, or the second beast, twice as dangerous as the first. Remember, that first beast is Freddy Krueger. You know to be scared of him. The second beast is more like the used car salesman. He slick talks you, and before you know it, you're signing a contract to a car you didn't even know you wanted in the first place. The dragon's greatest victories don't usually happen because somebody wakes up one morning and says, I think I'll be evil today. They happen because people slowly begin giving their allegiance to something other than Jesus. And the dragon will use all sorts of other things than Jesus to distract us. That's why instead of asking, could the mark of the beast be this, I think maybe a more important question should be, what is it that's shaping my mind and my actions? The forehead and the hand. The forehead represents how our thoughts are shaped. The hand represents what directs our actions. And do you remember way back in the Old Testament when the priests were given the law and told, you need to put the law two places. Do you know where they were told to put it? In a little box right here and in a little box right here. Because every time they would look at that, or they would look in the mirror, they would be reminded of what it is that is to shape their thoughts and their actions. The real danger isn't that. So think about it this way. The mark of the beast really isn't ultimate. It's about allegiance before it is identification. The real danger isn't accidentally receiving a barcode. The real danger is gradually, step by step, one wrong next step after another. I haven't said it that way. I had a hard time getting that out. Taking one step after another and becoming the kind of person who thinks like the beast, loves what the beast loves, and works for the beast kingdom before they even realize that it's happening. That kind of deception is far more dangerous because it feels normal. We're not likely to stumble into this by accident. It's something that we slowly drift into when our loyalties are pulled left and right and everywhere but where they need to be. Which is exactly why John ends that passage with, "This calls for wisdom." I think that's what we would love for God to just give us all the pieces of the puzzle. He didn't even have to put them together. We'll take that. We can run with that. We can do that. Just give us all the pieces. But he doesn't do that. He gives us enough of the picture to be able to put together and fill in the blanks, but it calls for wisdom. Let the one who has ears to hear what the Spirit is saying to the churches. And if we have the Spirit living in us, guess what kind of ears we have? Ears that are able to hear and discern what it is that the Spirit is saying. We should be the last ones who are pulled astray by this stuff. It takes spiritual discernment to recognize a deception that doesn't look like a deception. But thankfully, once again, Revelation doesn't leave us staring at the monsters. Because next week, guess where we're going to be right back at? We're going to be right back in the throne room. I don't want to jump ahead. We'll be in the throne room next week. You can go there now if you'd like. And we're going to see what it is that marks the people of God. It's not the beast. It's the Lamb. The dragon wants to put his mark on our minds and our hands. And if you belong to Jesus, he has already marked you as his own. That is our deepest identity. We belong to the Lamb that was slain and is now alive. So don't spend your life chasing conspiracy theory after conspiracy theory or trying to decode everything. John wasn't writing this. He wasn't given this vision to give to us to make us suspicious of everything. He was writing to make us faithful. So when the monsters roar and the culture pressures us to compromise and the world tells us that power, fear, or wealth deserve our ultimate trust, we need to remember who we are. Who has marked us? We have been marked by the Lamb. Those monsters might look terrifying, but they're only a string of sixes trying to be a seven. They're never going to get there. There's only one who deserves our allegiance, and that is the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. We have been marked by a different king, so guard your mind. Offer your hands in service to the Lamb. Practice patient endurance. Remain faithful. The Lamb is already on the throne, and he has already overcome.